Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz live from the Kintech studio. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Bridge Street Dunbar Lumber in Ladner has moved to Progress Way in Tilbury's Industrial Park. More room, more product, more awesome. Details at DunbarLumber.com. Get your thoughts in. Big Friday edition of the show. Ian McIntyre is going to join us momentarily here. We'll get his thoughts on the Canucks with the regular season looming next week. And, of course, our first hit of the year with Dmitry Filipovich is coming up at 1:30.
Oh, we got to figure out something to draft.
Yes.
Also,
why start now? Wait, do it in an hour and 15 minutes. Come up with something.
Sounds good. I'll think about it, though. In the meantime, also, we didn't even mention during the whiteboard that the NHL regular season kicked off this morning.
Yes, it's underway.
Yeah.
It's currently underway as we speak. We're watching it.
Jacob Markstrom killing it, by the way.
Yeah, the Devils beating the Sabres 3-1 in Prague.
Tage Thompson, not so much.
The funniest part about this to me is that the Devils played a preseason game in Philadelphia last night. While not the real part of the team, coaching staff, all of that, not even on the same continent, but they were somehow playing a preseason game.
And then they had like eight guys on waivers today
because they had to hold everyone to play that preseason game against the Phillies.
Philly.
I got Major League Baseball on my mind.
The Devils playing the Phillies is truly
a
mark.
That's a bizarre preseason game.
It's been the worst NHL preseason ever, and I feel like that's a fitting capstone on it.
All right, without further silliness, let's bring in our colleague from Sportsnet, the Triple Threat TV Radio and sportsnet.ca, of course. He is Ian McIntyre. Hi, Mac. How's it going, man?
I'm doing very well. I understand it's still raining downtown, which I guess I know because I was at the rink, but it's sunny out here in Steveston. It's always sunny in my world, as I like to tell people. Todd Bertuzzi once told me that as well. During his grumpiest peak years in Vancouver, he said, "It's always sunny in my world."
Interesting.
And he said it kind of like that. So.
Yeah. I'm not sure I believe him there, but fair enough.
No.
I'm glad he perceived it that way anyways. All right, so
when I think sunshine and rainbows, I think Todd Bertuzzi.
Todd Bertuzzi, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Mr.
Butterflies floating over a meadow, babbling brook, relaxing, reading poetry by the stream.
Oh, man. All right. So for me, you know, as we get ready to start the regular season here, IMAC, one of the most interesting things is just how different this team is positioned this year compared to some of the most recent seasons, right? Where so much of the talk has been, are they going to get things together, right? Can they get off to a good start? Can they at least hang tight in the playoff race? And now, of course, with the success of last year, there's the weight of greater expectations. I think it's a very different mood around the team. And, you know, obviously you've had a lot of opportunities to be around the players, talk to some of them from training camp and now through the preseason. What's your sense of how the players perceive that new challenge and how they're handling it?
Well, they seem pretty dialed in, but we're going to find out next week. But it's one of the things, one of my personal themes, my journalistic themes that I've been sort of exploring since training camp began is how this group would handle success, because handling adversity is pretty, I'm not going to say it's easy. Adversity by definition is not easy, but it's not complicated when it comes to sports. You know, you lose, you got to be better, train harder, make your team better, work harder, be more, you know, all these things. It's pretty obvious when you had some of those dismal seasons that they had. Well, all of a sudden you have a 50-win, 109-point season. Well, how do you handle that? Especially for youngish, but not inexperienced, but youngish core players who hadn't had that success, not in front of fans. You know, it was such an artificial thing, a couple of months in the bubble in Edmonton in 2020, that wasn't real hockey. So I've kind of been asking guys about that all along. And, you know, even guys I know pretty well and can have a conversation with where my tape recorder or my Otter app isn't running. Everybody seems pretty dialed in. They seem wary of that narrative that, you know, they, you know, had this remarkable season last year that no one expected, and now they're going to fall back to earth. I think they're wary of that. I also don't think they're fearful of it. I think there's a lot of confidence in the group. But like I said, we're not going to know until next week because Jamie used the term like get the team together. It's funny how things evolve in the league in the preseasons. This, to me, where you only get your team together for the last game and maybe they had the last two, that's not a whole lot of time. Like, we all agree the preseason needs to be reformed. But I think, you know, having more than just one game with your NHL roster before the first game that counts is advantageous. But this is where we are. They certainly seem dialed in. They've got injuries to deal with, which is a huge question mark, sort of cap wise and opening night roster wise. But as far as sort of focus and intensity, it seems like they're where they need to be.
What's your expectation going into this season, IMAC, about how the Canucks stack up relative to, let's just go, the other teams in the Pacific?
Well, I mean, Edmonton is Edmonton. But I don't see any reason why the Canucks and the Oilers shouldn't be, you know, the class of the division. There's probably more disparity within this division than there is anywhere else. So you would think that for the good teams at the top of the division, that might, you know, translate to some easy points at times. But I don't think the Canucks are going into San Jose and winning 10-1 this year. Anaheim, who knows? Vegas, they always seem to be kind of slipping a little from where they were, but they always prove to be a tough out. So I think the Oilers, though, they're the team to beat not only in this division but in this league this year with what they've been able to add at fairly low cost. And of course they have questions, like every team has questions, and this has to go right and that has to go right. But you know, you've got two of the best players in the world who are extraordinarily motivated. They're going to be a lot hungrier than, say, the Florida Panthers will be because of that one game that mattered most. And I think Edmonton is going to be really tough to beat, to win, you know, retain the division pennant. But I think the Canucks should be up there at least in second.
Ian, you know, you made the point about the players. Okay, you had to deal with adversity. That's one thing. Not that it's easy, but now dealing with success is a different challenge altogether. And I was kind of thinking, I wonder how much that applies to Rick Tocchet and the coaching staff as well. Again, not to say that there's anything easy about the job that Rick Tocchet did with the team last year, but I do think about, you know, back to him taking over from Bruce Boudreau, and we all knew how poor the team's defensive performance was, right? So not that it was easy to correct, but at least it was maybe low-hanging fruit. It's like, okay, this is what we need to fix first and foremost. We have to focus on this beyond anything else. They accomplished that last year, and now it seems like the challenge is, okay, we got that done. Where are those other edges where we can improve? Is this in some ways almost a more challenging job for Rick Tocchet than what he had going into last season as well?
Yeah, I think it is. And also, you make a good point about the low-hanging fruit. A coach always first of all, a new coach is always going to have the player's attention. Yeah. And if he doesn't, you know, as an organization, you're in real trouble. But a new coach of a team that has underperformed is certainly going to have the player's attention because they're looking for help. They want somebody to guide them. And I think it was starkly clear to a lot of these players shortly after this change, as much as everyone, most of the guys, not everyone, most of the guys loved Bruce. And certainly we in the media liked Bruce because he was great for us. But I think it was clear to them pretty early on that, you know, this might work better now, you know, having some structure and some defensive stoutness, having some detail. Tyler Myers, we've talked about a lot. He's the perfect example of it, right? And even Tyler acknowledges how much easier it is to play when you know where everyone is supposed to go, everyone understands their job and what they need to do on the ice, where they need to be on the ice, and you can play with some dependability and confidence. So, yeah, I think initially And let's face it, it was an underperforming team. It wasn't a team that should have been as awful as it appeared to be. So there was talent here, and we saw a quick rise. Now they need to get to the next level, and I think Tocchet understands that he has to evolve. I think he even told us at the end of last season he's going to have to find, you know, new ways to instruct and connect and motivate players. I found it interesting when I had a conversation with him in Penticton at the Young Stars tournament that he basically said, yeah, he's got to be harder. And Rick Tocchet is a demanding coach. All the great coaches are demanded. There's nobody who isn't and has success in sports, as far as I can tell, as far as head coaches go. But as demanding as Tocchet has been and as insistent as he has been in the, quote, staples and their core beliefs and how things should be, I think there's going to be even less leeway. I mean, there really isn't, after last season, there really isn't any reason for any of the returning players not to understand fully exactly what's expected and understand that compliance is mandatory. It's not optional. And Tocchet said in September, he said, there were times where maybe you let things go because you can't be on the players all the time. You can't point out every little mistake over and over. I think he's going to be pointing out pretty much all the mistakes now because he says he has to. That's the next level for them to be better. And then, you know, the big picture thing, you know, the small picture thing, the micro view was, you know, fixing these things that we talked about, getting some structure, fixing the defending, reducing, you know, the what they were surrendering. So that was sort of the tactical thing, but the broad picture was about building this culture and building a system for players where, you know, the players take ownership of it. And I think they still have a little ways to go in that. And as that gets stronger, maybe the team gets a little better as well. Then, you know, there are other things. If you're asking literally how can they be better, well, we know the power play can do no more. We know that they can score a little bit more. You know, so there are things on the ice.
A little bit more, right. Mac.
Well, hopefully. Well, I'm not
it's not sure about scoring more. It's not about scoring more, but like a few shots here and there. Yeah. Ideally, with Quinn Hughes not on the ice, would be excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm not convinced they're going to be this high-powered offensive team. I think they are going to score more.
They'd have to change their stripes entirely to be a high-powered offensive team again. Yeah. I mean, they shot a historic clip, right? And we saw in the second half. I mean, look, the Edmonton Oilers act from October and November, once that evaporated, I mean, we saw in the playoffs, right? Like they needed a circus act to pull out goals in some of these games, right? It was 6-on-5. It was, and they didn't have a baseline to fall back on. Like, do you think, because we've seen so much emphasis on it, both in terms of who they brought in and what they worked on at camp, and how Rick Tocchet has sort of talked about it. How do you sort of see the loosening of the reins, the goal of getting more offense generated, fitting in with sort of the culture, the staples, and the predictability that Tocchet has so successfully brought here? Do you see those things in tension at all going into the season?
Well, I know I see the intention. Are we going to see the execution? And you know, we just talked about Tocchet and what sort of tolerance, you know, close to zero he may have for non-compliance of what they want to do. But that too will be tested, you know, when they take chances to score more. And that's what offense is all about, right? It's risk and reward. Mm. And the Canucks have been a low risk team because they play so well defensively, and that's been enough. And I think we all know that they're not going to shoot whatever it was, 11-point-something% as a team.
Nearly 12.
Yeah, this year again. So they're going to have to find goals in another area. I think that they have spent a lot of time talking about weak side opportunities and mm-hmm. and seeing how much more they can generate if they move the puck across to the weak side and if they have a player hanging out on the weak side rather than as closely and strongly supporting the puck as they've been in the past. So that's one thing, but then, you know, it's all a balancing act. So if they take these risks to score more, and again, it's calculated risk, but they open themselves up a little bit more at the back, is the coaching staff going to live with that? I mean, the default position is to play from the goal out, right? Take care of your own end, limit what the other team does, and then rely on your talent and hopefully your power play to take care of the other end. That's an easy, it's kind of a very sensible way to play, but will they default too much to the defensive side if in trying to score more, they're not as strong a team, they're not as solid, they're not as tight a team? It's hard to do both, right? That's why that Canuck team in 2011 was so remarkable. They led the league in scoring and led the league in goals against. And that's incredibly rare to have that double. So I do think they're going to score more. At what cost, you know, defensively, it remains to be seen. But I don't think we're going to see, as you point out, Thomas, we're not going to see them change their stripes and reinvent themselves. They just need to play like they did last year and score a bit more.
And one of the, I find that tension interesting from a kind of global perspective of the team, but also really fascinating when you sort of start to drill down to individual players, right? And I look at a guy like Daniel Sprong, and we all know the book on him at this point, right? Where it's, hey, really talented offensively, incredible shot, has had trouble earning the trust of coaches and breaking through and really claiming a role with a franchise. You know, it looks like he's going to get a chance to start with Elias Pettersson and Jake DeBrusk, and that's a situation where, as you say, if Rick Tocchet is even committing more so to, okay, everyone has to play to the staples, less tolerance for mistakes than in last season, and you have a guy like Daniel Sprong coming in who they've also talked about, well, it's going to be a process, we're going to need to work with him. I'm just really interested to see kind of what happens when the rubber hits the road and, okay, we want to score more, and that makes us put Daniel Sprong in the lineup on the second line, but we also want to make sure everyone is playing exactly to the staples. And that's just one player where I feel like we're really going to see how the coaching staff works through this tension kind of in real time at some point this season.
Yeah, I haven't, on a professional level, I haven't gotten to know Sprong very well yet. So I can't, you know, I don't know how he's wired. I know that he has said the right things about, and I think Tocchet told us this as well, that he has owned his deficiencies and he really wants to get better. And, you know, Tocchet has said Sprong is a guy who reaches out by text and is constantly asking for video. How do I do this? How should I do this? So let's just say that he's got the right attitude. Let's assume that's the case. If that is the case, I don't really see why anyone would bet against him becoming a more well-rounded player when you see the case studies that are already in front of us here in Vancouver. Look at the player that Brock Besser has become. Look at the player that JT Miller has become. Look at Nils Höglander and what he has done. Even someone like Connor Garland, There's far more, in my opinion, there's far more sort of substance and grit to his game, even though you don't necessarily think of those things when you think of this dynamic, you know, playmaking winger.
Whirling dervish?
More, yeah. I was trying to think of something that wouldn't make me sound like I'm even older than I am.
like you're a newsie.
You whirling dervish. You should do a poll question. What is a dervish? Give multiple answers. See how many people know. I even only have a vague idea of what that is, but we know that your vocabulary is better than everyone else.
We'll ask Dollywall.
Yeah, that would be good. That would be good live. So I think, you know, if Sprong is really committed to doing this, I just don't see why he can't be a better player and have a transformation, maybe not to the extent of a couple of these other examples I mentioned, but why not? This coaching staff has proven that it seems to me that it's been able to get the most out of players. Like who has gotten worse under this regime? Like it's hard to identify anybody.
I mean, Kuzmenko.
Guys who, yes. Well, I mean, what was he at the start and what was he when he left? I don't know that there was any difference. I don't know that he got worse. I think, you know, Podkolzin didn't progress the way they had hoped.
Mikheyev?
Well, Mikheyev had the injury. You know, it's hard to fully judge Mikheyev because of that ACL. So I just think there's a lot of case history of guys, if they're willing.
Ooh, I've got a controversial one for you. What about Pettersson?
Okay.
Wow. All right.
Yeah.
I was just going through. I was looking at the roster. You challenged. Yeah. I was like, okay, what about Pettersson? Would we say unreservedly that Pettersson was better under Tocchet than he was under Boudreaux? I think we'd probably at least have reservations about it.
Oh, no, I think he's a better player now. But is he his best? I don't think he's had, to your point, I don't think he's had the spike in performance or the elevation of his overall game that these other guys that I've mentioned have had. But his overall game was higher than everybody else's to start with. So there's not a whole lot. I mean, what is this? I don't know what Pedersen's ceiling is, but I know that he can still be better. And I think he's one of the guys that Tocchet and the staff have worked with a lot in a way. I think that Elias Pedersen's struggles in the playoffs are going to turn out to be a very good thing. Because I think it was probably the first time in his hockey life where between his world-class elite skills and his intense, thoughtful, savvy introspection, he wasn't able to figure it out on his own. I think he's been able to figure out all along the way what it is he needed to do. And suddenly in the playoffs, he wasn't figuring it out. And I think maybe that's going to be a kind of awakening for him. I'm really, really interested to see the season that Pedersen has. And of course we know, like in a very superficial way, if you look at the achievements of their core players last year in, you know, Quinn Hughes and the Norris and Demko runner up for the Vezina, JT 103 points, Besser 40 goals, even though the GM said he should have scored 50. You know, where is the room for those guys to elevate further? And again, I'm speaking in a superficial way, just in their points and stuff. I think that Pedersen can probably do better than what he did, and especially in relation to those other guys. So I think he's a huge, huge X factor for the team this year. I mean, they've gotten them wingers. Right. I mean, so that's not that it was an excuse, you know, air quotes per se, but we know that he didn't have at times most of the time, the quality of line mates that JT Miller had. Well, now he's got quality line mates. And I'm not sure that Sprong will necessarily find a home on that line, but maybe he will. But there's other guys. That's the thing about this team and the players they added. There's other guys they'll try. They don't lack quality wingers now, like you could have argued was the case a year ago. So it's going to be really interesting to see how Pedersen does.
Mac, in the interest of time, we should cut you loose, but I just want to ask you one more, just because we're earnestly trying to figure out where our expectations should be set for Thatcher Demko. We have no idea how to do it. Do you have any idea or any guidance for us or our listeners in terms of what to expect in any aspect of Demko's return or performance this upcoming season?
Well, it's going to be fascinating to watch, but no, I'm just going to, you know, be honest and say, no, I don't. I don't wish I could help.
No,
I can't. I can't in a concrete way, but I'll say this. I think this is going to be just absolutely fascinating because first and foremost, we're all talking about the injury and understandably so. And when's he going to be back? And then on top of that, talked about a little less, but still fairly prominent, is, well, look what happened the last time he came back from injury. You know, he had that disastrous season 2 years ago, ended up getting hurt again, was brilliant at the end, and it was too late. Is he going to be better when he comes out? Is he going to stay healthy this time when he comes back? So that's another question. But then the third thing, which might be the most interesting, how is he going to do without Ian Clark? And is his play going to, will his form suffer? Or is it possible he's going to feel a certain amount of freedom, liberation, for lack of a better term? And we already saw a different Thatcher Demko that first day of training camp when he spoke to us. And that was great that Thatcher wanted personally to address his status, the best that he could. But when's the last time we saw Demko that open and engaging towards us? Are we going to see a different kind of player? Is he entering another stage of his career now as a professional? And I think all of this is going to be fascinating to watch. I'll say only as far as concrete, like, when's he going to be back? I had thought when he spoke to us on day one of training camp that by now we might have seen more of him on the ice. Mm-hmm. We might have seen him with the group even at times. We might have seen him practice. And the fact that we still haven't seen that obviously is not there's been nothing encouraging to other than what Rick Tocchet tells us, that Thatcher's having good days and they're happy with that. As far as on the ice, we haven't been able to see anything to say, yes, he's this much closer or that much closer. And that's a little bit disconcerting since the regular season starts on Wednesday.
Hi, Mac. Love having you on. Thanks for doing this, man. Enjoy the sunny skies in Steveston. Hopefully we'll chat again soon.
I will. I'm thinking of going to Gary Point.
There you
Maybe
go.
Taking a blanket, having a picnic.
Play some music. Whirl like a dervish.
All right, you know I'm looking up dervish. I'm not sure I kind of know what it is. Like, I can picture it, but I don't know the origin. So,
I think it's like a Turkish spinning dancer.
Well, that's what somebody texted. Yeah. I think it's more of like a warrior. But it's like an old. But maybe now it's a.
But I think it's like a top. Like, I think it was like a popular toy. In
yes.
Yeah. So I think it's like yeah. Anyway.
Right. But
have
there
a
is
great
an origin to the
weekend, Mac. Enjoy the sunshine. Enjoy the last preseason game. Let's go.
Yes, absolutely. I'll talk to you guys again.
Thank you, Ian. That is Ian McIntyre from Sportsnet, and of course, a regular contributor here, brought to you, that Canucks Insider, by Avenue Machinery. Hey, they sponsor our show, too, and Douglas Lake Equipment. Let Kubota do your heavy lifting.
Love the folks at
Visit
Avenue
them
Machinery.
Online at DLEAMC.com. Every time we have iMac on and I do the read, I'm like, we should have more often. We're sponsor buddies with them. We're all part of the Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment family. All right, we will take a break. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Also, preseason coverage on 650 is brought to you by Tiletown. As BC's favorite hockey team kicks off a new season, receive 20% off any regular priced in-stock tile. Visit mytiletown.ca for details. Get your texts in. We'll hear from Rick Tocchet. Open segment next before Dimitri joins us at 1:30 here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.
Sounds so much like a NOS track.
You know, Randeep filled in, or not filled in for the whole show, but was on for the last hour, and I told him about that. He took my side, disagreed, said, not grimy enough.
All the people who don't really listen to Nas.
The look you just gave there was incredible. Yeah. Biting your tongue so hard.
Well, if hip-hop expert Randeep.
Randeep's a big 90s hip-hop guy.
I know he is, actually. But come on. I'm definitely right. It's all good.
Randeep was also like, yeah, Jamie, you and I have very similar music tastes. I was like, whoa. Just you, just on where hip hop is concerned. I don't think Randeep's doing as much Warren Zevon listening as I am in my spare time.
I thought you were going to say war on drugs.
War on drugs, yeah. I know.
Your Warren saying needs some work.
I wanted to go to that show. We get random draws.
Yep.
I missed out on it, unfortunately, for the Rogers one, so I was not able to go. I missed out on the Weezer one, too. I had no interest in Weezer until I found out that they're playing the Blue Album in its entirety at the show.
Yeah,
and
then
I was like, okay, now I want to go.
100%.
That actually sounds awesome. I'm in now.
I saw Jizz and RZA do Liquid Swords front to back.
What?
Yeah.
When was this?
This was for the, I guess it was the 15th or 25th anniversary of it in New York. The Knitting Factory. Years and years ago. It was awesome. When
That's
I was young
fantastic.
And cool.
Oh, I love Liquid Swords.
It's unreal. It was,
go home
it was
and listen
awesome.
To Liquid Swords now.
Honestly, I do think that this is what bands should be doing. I think they should be doing classic albums front to back as concerts. Like,
it's great.
That makes it such an event.
Yeah.
You know?
Plus, it's always like when you go see a legacy act, you're like, well, I don't really want to listen to the new stuff. So
100%.
Then they give you the guarantee and you're like, all right, great.
Oh,
I'm in. They're going to play all the songs I like.
When I saw Arcade Fire at Rogers Arena last year, it was just so weird to me how it was like half the songs I was like, oh, this is my jam. And half the songs I was like, I could go to the bathroom.
I have no emotional reaction to this
zero.
Whatsoever.
No. Forget my emotional reaction. I have zero interest. It was so weird.
Anyways. This is Canucks Talk. I'm Jamie Dodd. That's Thomas Drantz. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Let Kubota do your heavy lifting. Visit them online at dleamc.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And I do just want to read this text because some variation of it has come in an awful lot. I touched on it, just kind of the idea on it on the show yesterday as well. But this one comes in unsigned. Any chance of a Tucker Poolman trade in the next 24 hours? And I know every time this has come up, even going back to last year when we were still doing the show, right?
Yeah, the club's not going to part with assets
has
to do
been
it.
No. Now, the only thing I would say
it's
is...
It's uninsured. Like, I don't know this 100%, but my understanding is it's an uninsured contract. So
okay.
It's just like...
So the other team is paying out the cash, too. Then.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the... To me, that's the big stuff.
No, you have to pay significantly to get rid of that deal.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, like I saw Ethan Bear hit waivers and Chester Ming on Twitter sort of asked me, like, would the Canucks do Poolman for Ethan Bear? And it's like, no, because you'd have to attach an additional asset to it to get a live body for... you know, a de facto retired contract that's going to cost you money. So,
to me, the fact, if it's not insured, that is what really makes the cost prohibitive.
The club is not shy about spending future assets to improve the team, but they're not going to spend future assets to, like, make administering the cap slightly easier. That's just, that's philosophically a decision that they've long since made.
But the only... My only response to that is, couldn't you look at it as, okay, if that's the thing that allows us to accrue and toll cap space, isn't that part of ultimately making the team, being aggressive to make the team better?
Sure, but the it's not from a lack of trying that they've made this determination, you know? Like, they've, gauged the market price, they're
to
unwilling to pay it,
yeah.
You know? Like, that was true in March, it's true today, it's... You know, that I mean, how early in the offseason did I report that?
Yes, exactly. It's been the line since this idea started coming up.
Yeah, so it's just not something the club's willing to spend assets on, right? They want, if they're spending assets, they want to upgrade the roster. They'll spend assets on that, but they're not going to spend assets to rid themselves of the Poolman contract. You know, that's been the sort of operative philosophy all season long. Could it change now that, you know, injuries have mounted in the again, like, everything can change. It's hockey. And it's a Jim Rutherford, Patrick Alvin-led front office that's, you know, been wildly aggressive in everything they've done since they sort of joined the since they took the reins of the organization. So I never want to say never, right? Like, I don't think the club is aggressively looking to make a deal this weekend the way they have in past years. But... Does that mean that one won't happen? No. Things can change in a heartbeat, right? A team like in Nashville, okay? In Nashville, you've got Tanner Molendijk, their 2022 first-round pick or 2023 first-round pick, still on the roster with 25 bodies remaining, and he's playing third pair four of them in their last preseason game. Okay, so does a name that no one expected to shake loose off the Nashville roster, could that surprise the Canucks front office and all of a sudden they're looking at it a little differently? 100%, right? So, you know, I never want to say never. I don't want to say this isn't going to happen, but to this point, the club philosophically has gauged the market on moving the Pullman contract, has decided it's a price that they're not willing to pay, and I have no indication that posture has changed.
There you go. It makes sense, the idea of the cost just being prohibitive. Right?
Yeah, it's teams aren't lining up to take that deal on.
No.
Like, I don't know what else to tell you. Teams don't want it, and the Canucks don't want to pay to get off of it.
All right, let's hear from Canucks head coach Rick Tocchet again. It is the final preseason tune-up for the Canucks tonight at Rogers Arena, 7 o'clock against the Edmonton Oilers, both teams starting what looks to be something, you know, very close to their opening night rosters. Rick Tocchet spoke to the media, of course, after the game day state. Here is the head coach of the Vancouver Canucks.
Yeah, I saw a lot of excitement, you know. Some guys haven't played, and some guys only played one game, so I think that guys are excited to play. I think, too, at this point, you get down to numbers where it's, you know, we've had some really good practices. You know, camps, a lot of people around. I think you can see the excitement of guys. Okay, this is somewhat basically our team, so you're seeing a lot more excitement there.
And, of course, JT Miller back in the lineup tonight. What can you say about him and just the addition that he is to this group?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we know how we all feel. He's one of the best centers in the league, two-way, the whole deal. So he's anxious to play. He's skated a lot this camp. Came in great shape, so I'm not really worried about him.
Rose back out there with you this morning, that's got to be a good sign.
Yeah, kind of get a little more pace to see how he feels after. It's not usually the next day, so, yep, see how he is.
And Teddy will play tonight?
Yeah, Teddy's in. Yep, that's basically the lineup tonight.
Is your concern level evolved on Hughes' situation?
No, he skated, and I haven't actually talked to Roman, so I'll get a report, but he skated early today. So usually when a guy skates, you know, from that, you know, it's not as bad, but I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, I think so.
I know that, you know, last season, the way it ended with you guys playing Edmonton, I know it's still preseason now, but is there quite a bit of excitement to kind of get this last preseason game against Edmonton?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they got their full lineup. You know, it's an exhibition game, but, you know, it's still a game that, you know, you want to play hard in. You know, they knocked us out. You know, I give them a lot of respect for what they went through at the beginning of the year to be one goal from winning Stanley Cup. So, you know, the rivals are, we're striving, you know, to beat them. That's what you look for, whether it's exhibition or regular season. That's what you try to do.
Already go the distance tonight? Is that the plan?
Yeah. I think already will go the distance. Yes.
It's your first preseason game with the full lineup, yeah. All the forward lines, all the defense pairings. Is there any concern about getting ramped up enough for the regular season or just one game?
Yeah, I don't think so. You know, it's our job as coaches to, you know, put practices where there is intensity and you try to mimic it. But I think a lot of teams go through the same thing. You know, you don't have your full lineup. I honestly don't see there's going to be much rust. I think we've had some really good practices. I think it's been a good camp for a lot of guys. So, no, I don't see any rust or anything like that.
From the start of training camp, you talked about wanting to bring in more speed, adapting your system to producing more offense, taking a few more risks. Have you seen that throughout the preseason and continuing into practices too?
Yeah, I've seen us push a little bit. Got to get better on some conversions. And I think whether you want to call it another level of burning a team when we have the odd man rush, I still don't think we're there yet. But it's October. Like, I mean, you know, we're not going to be the, you know, Central Army team back in the Russian Five yet. But we're striving for that. And, you know, that kind of where teams, if they over-aggressive, we got to have a good conversion rate. And we have to, you know, we got to get up the ice a little quicker. But I did see that. And we did a lot in practice this year, the last 2-3 weeks. Well, you look for consistency, sustainability, and sometimes spots, you know, a center position, a defensive position, sometimes get a little bit more, you know, strong weighted because those are important positions. But really it's sustainability. Like, you know, I think I told you guys before, you know, you play a good game, can you play a couple, string it together? And you don't always have to play great, but can you just be sustainable in the way you play? That you can be a reliable guy. You know, we know that you're going to be in these positions most of the time, where sometimes as a younger guy or a guy that's trying to make the NHL, they, I don't want to say they lose focus, but it's so fast sometimes and it's hard to sustain it. I haven't really seen that from Baines or Rats. You know, they've done a nice job especially the last 2-3 games. And I thought I'm not playing tonight. I thought he played a good game last game. I thought Friedman's had a great camp. He's not playing tonight. So it's a good thing to have this depth.
That is Canucks head coach Rick Tocchet, again, speaking to the media before his team takes on the Edmonton Oilers tonight at Rogers Arena in the final preseason game on their schedule. And some quick injury updates, or at least notes there from Rick Tocchet. Mentioned Hirose on the ice, said, yeah, they wanted to get him a little bit more pace, see how he feels tomorrow after getting that pace. And that's, as you said, right, part of clearing concussion protocol is, okay, how do you feel the day after you've been out skating in a practice situation like Hirose was today? So yeah, we're talking acknowledging that part of the process as well.
A morning skate, you know, whether he's in non-contact or not, I wasn't there, so I didn't see exactly what the workload looked mm-hmm. like, right? So this could be stage 4 or 5, depending, right? On whether or not it was like a full team practice environment or whether or not he was out there as, a limited participant or in a non-contact. So whether he was or not, right, doesn't necessarily yeah. denote his level of activity from a protocol standpoint. So, yeah, we'll see. The Hirose complication is a possible one. The Suter one is another one, right? We haven't seen him yet.
Yeah, and he said Suter skated before the rest of the team today,
right.
So he is skating. Now, Tocchet also said he was going to wait to get an update from the guys who were skating, or, you know, the members of the staff who were skating with Pius Suter. Tocchet said, you know, not specifically in this situation. Generally, when a player starts skating, that means they're progressing, of course. So we'll see. I mean, I guess the telling thing for Suter would be if he can practice with the group over the weekend, mm-hmm. that probably sets him up to be an option for game one
yep.
on Wednesday. If not, then probably unlikely that he gets into the game
yeah.
on Wednesday.
And certainly changes the opportunity ahead of Neil Zaman, right? And of Ratu, right? In terms of potentially opening up one of those, that third line center spot. And then I suppose the other thing that's worth noting here would be the side of it where you've got, okay, so to this point, we've been dealing with indefinite timelines on Dakota Joshua and Thatcher Demko. And in some form or fashion, we're going to get clarity Monday, mm-hmm. Tuesday when the club sets their opening day roster, because, you know, a player who goes on LTI is lost for 10 games, right? Or,
yep,
or 2 weeks. A player that goes on normal IR is lost for a week. So not like firm timelines, but we're going to have at least a better sense of what the organization's thinking and anticipating, most likely, in terms of the length of those absences at some point next week. Just a note, right? We know so little about where those two are at in terms of their recovery. We know that Dakota Joshua was planning to go on the road trip, on and on. You know, as Mac noted in the last segment, and I think is worth noting, like, we haven't really seen Demko skating yet. I always sort of back of a napkin suggest that a player dealing with a long-term injury, once they resume practicing, you can kind of start a clock and it's 7 to 10 days.
Yep.
Well, we haven't even started that clock yet. So we will learn something about that also next week. Just something that, as I consider taking attendance, looking at sort of where the club's positioning themselves, the language that you can sort of read from a team's administrative actions, we will get at least more clarity on those situations next week.
Yeah, and the Demko one, I mean, I guess it just depends what your baseline expectations were, right? Because I was not anticipating him playing certainly the first game of the season at any point, right?
So what do you mean by at any point? I mean, in August, the club was still hopeful officially,
yeah.
but it was
but
uncertain.
Like, since the beginning of training camp.
Well, you sure. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so
once we had a sense of just how rare the injury was, I think we understood that we'd have to settle in. But that
yeah.
wasn't until September. I mean, we've been talking about this for months. And of course, it's been how many months since the injury occurred? 7?
Yeah.
But you know,
really,
I mean, are dealing with a long-term injury.
Since that
here.
Point, it's like, okay, well, like, let's get to November and see where we stand has kind of been what I'm thinking, right? Because of the rareness and how little information we have. It would just seem to be, it would seem to me, like, what are we? We're October 4th right now. To go from no timeline and not skating with the team to playing games in like the next 2 weeks, that would seem very, very fast to me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
not
no,
that
you're
it's
right.
impossible. He could start skating tomorrow and all of a sudden it's like, oh, okay, he's had some really good days. Like, I'm not saying this to be a downer, but it's just with the information we have, I've almost parked it as, well, I'll adjust my expectations when we get more information rather than, oh, is he going to be back by the 15th? Could he be back by the last week of October? It's like, we have no way of knowing. We have no way of even guessing right now because we have so little information. So I think for me, it's like, well, you got Shelovs and Lankinen. That should kind of be what you're expecting to roll with until we have something concrete either way from the team on Thatcher Demko there. Other note from Rick Tocchet, just again, continued to hammer the idea of sustainability being the key for the young players, right? Ratu, Baines, Oman, you know, said, look, you're not always going to be in the right spot, but are you showing that progress? Are you at least making it consistent enough? We talked about the positivity for Niels Amon, right? Not being in the lineup, kind of ironically. That's actually a good thing at this stage because it suggests that the coaching staff has a pretty good handle on what you can bring to the team.
You don't need to make closing arguments.
Yeah, it is a little surprising given that emphasis on sustainability, right? For me, because Tocchet talked about how well Niels Amon played in Edmonton on Monday, and then you would wonder maybe, okay, is he going to give him a chance to demonstrate that idea of sustainability? But maybe Tocchet has enough familiarity with Niels Amon's game that he thinks, okay, you know, we trust your ability to play a sustainable game, but we still need to see it from Ratu and Arshdeep Baines. And I think really that Ratu, Hoglander, Garland third line to me is going to be the most interesting thing to watch tonight. Just if Ratu can demonstrate enough, one, of his ability to play to the staples, but also that he brings some offensive spark and upside above and beyond Niels Amon, that he kind of forces the coaching staff's hand to play him there.
Yeah, right. And I do think Ratu is the most interesting name for us tonight from that roster battle perspective. This closing argument, I think, could matter for him. I don't know that it'll matter a ton for management, but I think it's different, right? There's always a tension, a push-pull between how management and coaching staff evaluate players. Coaches are looking at it from the perspective of trust. Mm-hmm. Management tends to be looking at it with a longer time horizon, right? That's why a player that's indispensable from the perspective of a head coach will be very much a replacement level in the eyes of management. You think about, like, a perfect example is a guy like Tyler Mott.
Yeah.
Right. If you're a coach, you're like, man, I cannot live without this guy. And if you're a management team, you're like, I can replace that guy this summer for $1 million. So I can't keep
We
him.
Can't grow attached to him.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's that tension. So from a coach's perspective, you go into this final game and it's like, I want to see sustainability. I also want to see, you know, meet pressure with pressure, Rick Tocchet. I want to see in this environment against a basically full Edmonton Oilers roster, right? And the pressure of being on the precipice of making an NHL team for the first time in your career, how does that affect you? Can you handle that? Can you perform in spite of that? That matters to me. Whereas management's like, we've seen enough from these guys. We know where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that's an interesting dynamic here, too. One of these guys, you know, is going to end up having Rick Tocchet banging the table in their favor this weekend. And that's a real prize. That's a substantive prize to earn, and that's at stake effectively for Baines or Ratu if they're able to show enough, right, that the answer is not just Niels Amon.
All right, final segment of the week coming up here on Canucks Talk. Dmitry Filipovich, first hit of the year in studio with us. Can't wait for that. Stick around for the final segment here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here live from the Kintec studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Bridge Street Dunbar Lumber in Ladner has moved to Progress Way in Tilbury's Industrial Park. More room, more product, more awesome. Details at dunbarlumber.com. It is 1:30 on a Friday, which means, of course, it is time for us to welcome in our pal, our close friend of the show, I would say. He is the host of the Hockeypedia-cast. He is Dmitry Filipovich, as Drance tries to distract him right as I introduce him with screenshots of his fantasy team.
Welcome back, Dmitry.
We are so back.
We are so back.
This is the perfect encapsulation of this entire program. Jamie's doing like a professional ad read. He's setting the scene for everyone. Tom's like nudging me to look at his dusty fantasy football team. It's the best of both worlds.
It's really bad.
A lot of, because we were all in the prep room in the bullpen before the show, a lot of Drance running parlays past you to, I would say, muted enthusiasm from you, Dmitry, is how I would characterize it.
He's all in on this Broncos-Raiders game this week, and I want nothing to do with it.
Jacoby Myers, baby.
Jacoby Myers.
Sure, you go with that.
Hey, I've got nothing else to go on, okay?
Dmitry, of course, is the host of the Hockeypedia-cast. I can't remember if I've said that already or not, but you can hear that on the Sportsnet Radio Network. You guys are back. I know you and Drance did a big two-parter to kick off the season. So the Hockeypedia-cast is back. Regular season in hockey is back, in Prague at least, not in North America yet, until next week. But it's oh so close. So let's start just kind of big picture on the Canucks here, right? Yep. I mean, we talked a little bit about the projection from The Athletic and, you know, Dom's model and all that, very, very high on them. How do you see this team stacking up in the Western Conference coming into the year?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. First off, I think, like, from a statistical perspective, we saw it already happen in the second half of last year with the shooting percentage regression a little bit, which I think we expected from the first half. The process, though, in place, which we documented throughout, especially defensively, is something that provides a very high baseline and a great foundation for this team. I expect that to continue. And then you look around the Pacific Division as well, and a lot of the teams that you could have theoretically talked yourself into being competition for the Canucks, at least for a second or third spot in the Pacific, if you want to put the Oilers there as kind of the placeholder at number one, got worse this offseason as well, right? Whether it's Vegas and all of their lack of depth and injury concerns. I really didn't like what LA did in terms of just doubling down on like toughness and size and misdiagnosing the reason why they keep losing Edmonton in round one, which is clearly a lack of skill. Instead, they just went the other way. Calgary, who I think we're going to talk about today as one of Vancouver's opening week opponents, has a strong case for worst team in the league, in my opinion.
Thank you.
And so
someone said it.
And all of a sudden, like, I think if we're just mapping it out in terms of reasonable projections, I think the Canucks very fairly should be slotted in that second slot right now in the Pacific Division, battling Edmonton for first. And so I think that's a very fair thing to say.
I'm not joining the chorus, though, on the Vegas belongs in a different tier than Vancouver. I mean, if you want to put Edmonton in a top tier, but I would just say I think there's a clear top tier in the Pacific. I don't think the Kings are in it. I think it's pretty clear, though, that Vegas should be. What's your take on their experiment to fill in things on the wall while relying on some of the, you know, engines of the team at center and defense?
Yeah, I think I'm higher on Vegas than the market, similar with you there, because I think if you just look at what happened to them after the trade deadline last year, right? Like, they bring in all these guys and none of them really have a chance to gel or play. And all of a sudden they're having to play a really strong Dallas team in round one and they take them to seven, of course. So I expect them with like a full off season of rest and extended one at that, considering they didn't make it to round two. Everyone coming in healthy, I would expect them to start strong. I think the injury concerns still linger, certainly. Like with Mark Stone, it's almost like a ticking time bomb at this point in terms of when his back is going to act up again or any number of injuries that he's incurred along the way. So I think they have their share of concerns. The thing with Vegas that I think is an important point to make is this clearly isn't going to be the team, like the one they have right now on their depth chart is not going to be the one they have in March or April.
You think they're going to be aggressive?
There's certainly going to be at least one or two stars who they somehow find a way to finagle onto their cap sheet that will be there in the second half of the season. Now, there's probably going to be 40, 50 regular season games that they might not maximize their point total along the way, which I think could help the Canucks in the standings. But in terms of like heading into the playoffs, what's this division going to look like? I think we should keep that in mind for Vegas.
So the potential for them to be kind of out-hitting their regular season record by the time the playoffs gets there, right?
Yes.
It's like, oh, okay, they only finished with 98 points, but all of a sudden people are like, they're a sneaky pick to win the Stanley Cup.
Yeah, oh, they have X, Y, and Z. They have a $102 million cap sheet right now,
Oh, I love that discourse every spring. Great that we get to have that debate again and again.
What do you make of the impact from a sort of relative team strength perspective of the uncertainty around Demko? Obviously, we have no idea how to sort of price in his like number of games played, how well he'll play, performance drop off coming back from injury, re-injury risk, all of that. So I'm not asking you to sort of pretend to be able to tell the future here, but
right.
How do you just sort of think about what it means for Vancouver to be entering this season without the sort of elite goaltending trump card that we've usually given this club?
I'd certainly the goalie position that puts the Canucks in place with 31 other NHL teams. I would say I'm perfectly fine with taking on that sort of like risk at that position in particular. Mm-hmm. Obviously you'd love to see Demko healthy, yep, and being able to play 50, 55, 60 games in the regular season.
Yeah.
What we just said about the defensive environment, right? Like I feel pretty confident that you're going to be able to put in not necessarily anyone, but if it's Shelovs and Lankinen or whoever you want to call up, like I think they're going to be able to get league average ish performance, mm-hmm, from them. Lankin in particular, as friend of my podcast and of your show, of course, Kevin Woodley, he'll gladly, I'm surprised he hasn't burst in here right now just at the name drop to shout about him. Yeah, so I think I'm not worried about that at all. Like if that's going to be one of your biggest concerns heading into the season, it's not ideal, but I'd gladly accept
that. Well, and similar to your point about Vegas, right, where it's like, okay, we're judging them based on October, but also it's going to matter a lot how they look in April. Like, okay, if Demko misses a big chunk of games in October, November, and even into December, let's say, or it's really slow getting him back up to speed, that's I think the Canucks are at a level now where that can reasonably be of less concern than, well, how is he playing in March when the playoffs roll around, right? And not to say that we know for sure he's going to be back to the old Thatcher Demko. Of course, there's a lot of uncertainty there. But I think for me, especially in the early part of the season, it's like, okay, they're not going to have Thatcher Demko. As you said, the defensive environment, Lankin and Shelov should be enough to tide them over. And then we could be having a very different conversation about their goaltending by the time the playoffs are here.
Yeah, and I don't even want to be putting those miles, even if he was healthy necessarily, on Demko in October and November, sure, right? Like, I think it's okay for them to ease him in,
yeah,
and for him to be trying to ramp up in around midseason, around the trade deadline, heading towards the playoffs. So.
Except as much as you'd prefer a load management regime or regiment for Demko through October, November, you have to be confident that he won't need it.
Right.
Once you get into May and June. Mm-hmm. So you do have to play him enough.
There has to be a ramping up process.
Yes.
Yeah. And obviously at a certain point, you're going to get to, it's like, okay, he needs to start playing regular games here.
Now, what about the offense? Because for me, goaltending uncertainty, I tend to agree with you, is not, you know, it's like teams that are trying to patch it together with running back in the NFL. I don't care. Goaltending is so uncertain, so volatile to begin with. These players are getting hurt so frequently. Teams are so frequently using four that, you know, if you're average and good defensively, average and net and good defensively, you're fine. The offensive side remains for me where I'm a little bit concerned about the Canucks, especially because so much of their defensive excellence last season was tied up.
Yep.
Was tied up though too in managing the puck conservatively.
Right.
Like if you're trying to turn the dial and take more chances and generate more, are you going to be able to do that, especially with when Quinn Hughes isn't on the ice, given the other defensive personnel this team has, and do it without sort of losing some of what was so good about this team's, you know, high baseline quality defensive identity? Where's your confidence at with where the Canucks sit there, given the personnel changes that we saw this offseason?
If you have Daniel Sprong on your roster, I'm not worried about your team offense. And I say that slightly tongue-in-cheek, but also,
yeah,
I think we've documented, like, he's one of the actual, like,
he's
shooting
NHL
percentage.
Jamal Crawford.
Well, he's one of the biggest, like, shooting percentage juicers in the league, and a lot of it is individually driven because, like, he's just such a sniper in that way. But I think for them to just be able to essentially plug him in and expect to get, what, 15 to 20 goals reasonably,
mm-hmm,
while playing bottom 6 minutes is huge for this team. I liked a lot of the additions they
made.
What
if he's playing with Pettersson? What happens when you throw two top 10 shooting percentage juicers on the same line?
This is what I'll say about that, though. And listen, there's few that are higher on Daniel Sprong as a character, personality, player skill set-wise than I am. He's on, what, his, like, sixth, seventh team potentially now? And every step along the way, the same thing happens. Like, he's going to play third, four, 5 minutes. because there's going to be situations where his coach, and especially Rick Tockett in this case, is probably going to be like, ah, that was a bit too rich for my blood. I didn't love that decision.
I'm going to do the Tobias Funke thing here and say it didn't work for them, but what if it works for us? And what if he does? Because I wanted to ask this too, right?
Yeah.
Specifically just like him as a fit next to Elias Pettersson, right? It's tantalizing to think about.
Yeah.
What does that look like? How do they complement each other?
I mean, theoretically, on paper, it makes a lot of sense. Like, he has certainly never seen a puck that he was unwilling to shoot. And I love getting that from Pettersson's sort of playmaking perspective and setting him up for that with a quick trigger beside him. I just think that question for me lingers where it's like, I just don't see a scenario.
How much time is he actually going to be
there? I don't see a scenario where we look up at the end of the day, at the end of the season, and Daniel Sprong has played average 17 and a half minutes per game. Like, he just hasn't done it yet in his career. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to happen in this particular circumstance either. That's okay, though. He's going to be amongst the league leaders on a permanent basis in 5-on-5 scoring, and I think that's just a boon for the Canucks. So I don't think that's like a negative thing. I just think that's a realistic approach.
What about using the Kuzmenko template where he only plays there situationally, and then once you have the lead, it's Sherwood?
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm okay with that.
In some ways, it's like not that he'd hold down 17 minutes a night, but could hold down playing with top team quality players,
right?
Given sort of a template we've already seen this Canucks team use to insulate, guys who have gaps in their defensive game.
I guess, especially with like from the Canucks perspective, I think Rick Tockett showed last year he would want to preferably lean on the bottom six as more like your traditional sort of defensively oriented
and
checking lines.
And Miller and Besser's line.
Yes.
Right? So that's the one thing where it's like, is there an opening for the Pettersson
to just
line
be like an extremely sheltered Sedin, like 75%?
Sheltered, but just like more sheltered than you would think of as typically a line with Elias Pettersson on, right?
Yeah. I think certainly heading into the year, like I want to keep the door open for that.
Yeah.
And check it out. I'd be curious to see what that looks like over a long haul. But yeah, heading into the season, if you're just looking for like instant puncher to get Pettersson off to a strong start, especially after how his season ended last year, I think that's pretty smart.
Are the Canucks going to be too dependent on having Quinn Hughes on the ice to manufacture offense?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, they certainly were in the postseason last year. You'd hope not, because similar in a sense to what we just talked about with Demko, I don't think you want to be putting 27, 28 minutes a night on Hughes's plate early in the season, especially with him taking hits and with having the big picture plan of like, all right, we want to make another long postseason run. So you'd like to think that wouldn't be the case. I have that in the back of my mind. Last time we watched them, it was a very puck dominant. Mm-hmm. Hughes has to create. If not, we're just waiting for Hughes to get back on the ice to do so. That question still lingers, and the moves they made on the blue line certainly this offseason aren't going to help alleviate that by any means, right? Like, I don't think you're bringing in guys like Vinny Desharnais and Derek Forbort, who have utility, but they're certainly not going to fill that gap. If anything, going from Zadorov's sort of freelancing and occasional individual brilliance offensively that we saw in the postseason to those two guys is a big step back in that regard. So, yeah, I think that's fair concern.
Is there any world where you think it makes sense to split up Hughes and Hronek because of these concerns?
Yeah,
I don't think we're going to see it on a consistent basis, right? Even Quinn Hughes was like, no, I don't want to do that. I want to play with Filip Hronek. Obviously, that counts for a lot, but because I think you're right. You know, you look at the guys who are going to be playing on the bottom two pairings, you don't see a lot of natural puck moving ability in those in that group. So they might have to think about switching up and breaking those guys up at some point.
Well, let me flip the question back on you guys then, especially Tom, watching this team sort of practice and prepare for the season up close. How much of what we saw towards the end of last year with Hronek's sort of diminishing efficiency, can we just squarely place on his health and the fact that he wasn't 100%? Because if we get the Hronek that we got in the first half of the season, I'd be like, all right, I'm willing to entertain having him sort of carry a second defensive pair that can chip in offensively. I think there's a point of diminishing returns if he's going to be closer to the second half version, because all of a sudden then it's like, not only did we make Hughes's pair worse, but all of a sudden Hronek's really, less efficient himself.
Are we really getting returns for it on the second pair? Yeah.
Yes.
Drance?
Dimitri
posed a question to you.
I was asking you about Hronek's health and how much of what we saw at the end of last year we can attribute directly to like, he wasn't himself compared to, all right, maybe the first half sort of overinflated how good he is.
Well, I think both things are true. I think
both things are true. Right.
I think
Drance was thinking about Mac Hollins.
I was thinking about another question. But the
I love how you started just segueing into a new topic.
No, the Hronek thing is like, I think Hronek, the first half of the season, and the way that this team ran, how purely they ran, yeah. I do think inflated sort of the production of everybody across the board, and certainly of the Hironic Hughes pair in general. But I also think that the Hironic we saw that was like tentative to shoot the puck, was not representative.
Right.
I also think there were gaps in his game that Hughes masked very effectively, even though he's still a hugely valuable contributor in his own right. I just think it's one of where it's not one or the other. They're both true, right? It's like Hironic was probably not as good last season as he looked in the first 3 months of the year, and certainly is better than he looked in the playoffs.
Yes.
You know, and sort of the baseline in there, for me anyways, probably more like a true talent 3, like 2-3 as opposed to a 1-2. But, man, the chemistry he has with Quinn, I think, makes him a clear top pair caliber guy on this team. Mm. I want to ask you one last one, which is the way the game's trending and how important star contributors are to the outcomes for teams. What does that mean for the Canucks, given how Miller, Hughes, Pettersson, Besser, like sort of all hit 95th percentile outcomes, with maybe the exception of Pettersson for 30 games down the stretch last season? Like, how much does the trappings of like goaltending uncertainty, or do they have enough puck moving on the back end, how much of that is just kind of irrelevant in comparison with can Vancouver's best players just do again what they did last year? And if they can, the team's fine.
I'd certainly be like much more comfortable relying on that than the alternative, where it's like a lot of these depth pieces just play it out of their mind, and it's like we're expecting them to have career years again, and it's like that's probably not realistic. So, I mean, listen, from year to year in the NHL, we know a lot of things change. It's never necessarily anything certain. I feel pretty confident betting on at least a lot of those guys that you listed there. And they also, a concept, Tom, you and I talk about a lot, is sort of outs, right? And that also provides the Canucks with a bunch of different outs for both the full season, but also individually game to game, where they have the defensive environment. Theoretically, the power play should be dangerous based on the personnel they had. I know they were a bit predictable as the year went on last year. And then you have guys like Hughes and Miller and Pettersson who can sort of have individual games where they just take over and they just have a 4 or 5 point game where they're the best player on the ice, and it doesn't really matter what anyone else does out there. And so you put all that together, and all of a sudden it gives you many different outs for winning games, as opposed to just relying on your goalie or just one particular facet of the game.
Quickly, as you mentioned, the Canucks will play their first regular season game before we chat with you again. Of course, that's next Wednesday against Calgary. As you mentioned, you like Calgary to be in the mix for potentially the worst team in the league. Give us your downside case. Why are you so down on the Calgary Flames?
Well, first off, you look at the depth chart right now and the roster they have heading into the season. I think it's already probably bottom 5 to 7 in the league. I think they've also telegraphed, based on how they acted last trade deadline, and then in the offseason, kind of adding a bit on the parts, right? Bringing in Manta for cheap. They just brought in Tyson Barry on a very low sort of commitment deal. I think if trades materialize or opportunities to sell even more present themselves, they're a very good candidate to make their roster even worse as the year progresses. So I think you're getting kind of a double whammy there, where all of a sudden they could be really bad and a bottom team heading into the season and get worse and have no real reason to try to accumulate points. So you look at all that, and I think I wonder what the odds are for finishing last in the league or whatever, but I feel like they're not going to be listed as one of the top teams, because I think the sort of incumbents are going to get a lot of that attention. But they're an interesting dark horse for me of like, wow, this team could be really, really bad this year.
What are we going to draft? Let's draft Soup season.
All right.
It's our last preseason draft, so we'll do something silly this one, and then serious
we'll do
next draft week.
Here. Yeah, we'll
have you been prepping
it
the entire time? Is that why you've been kind of quiet?
No.
You've been
I have
ranking soups?
Googling you think soups. You think I need to prepare to draft soup? Bro, I'm always ready for soup. All right.
Stay ready so you don't have to get ready.
I'm willing to pick wherever. So
all right.
Let's defer to our guest.
Yeah, let's give Dimitri the first pick.
You can go second.
Unless he needs prep time.
No, you know what?
Grant wants the snake spot.
I don't care at all.
You know what?
It's like, I want the turn.
Now, are you including like a chili
stews
here?
Yeah, chili is a soup. Ooh. But you can't be like beef chili and then someone else drafts like
turkey
red
chili
kidney bean chili.
Would we call chili a soup?
Well, we got to including stews.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a stew.
It's close enough.
All right.
Oh, man. You know what? I'm going to go with a tomato soup.
Ooh, classic.
It's a good
one. Because I just love it, especially with the grilled cheese. It's so nice. I don't need to justify my pick here, no. But everyone likes a good tomato soup.
100%. Do you want to go second or third?
I'm going to go with chili now that I know it's on the table.
You know,
I'll be honest. A couple of weeks ago, I woke up Saturday morning, and like the first thought that entered my head was, I want to cook a big bowl of chili today.
I love that.
I went out and I did it, and it was amazing. Yeah. I loved it. It was fantastic.
I like to make enough chili that I can eat it all week. You do that?
100%.
Oh, so good.
That chili, so much more filling than all the other soups.
Yeah,
and delicious.
Little bit of dark chocolate in there. Mm, let's go. Ooh,
baby. Okay, so I'm taking chili.
I like it. I'm going to go back-to-back Vancouver staples. I'm going ramen and I'm going pho.
Yeah.
Back-to-back. Feel very, very good about my picks.
Those are two good picks. Really I'm good. Going clam chowder, New Ooh, England.
That would have been next.
Chowder.
That would have been next for me.
Ooh, chili and clam chowder. Yeah, let's go.
You need a bread bowl, brother.
Oh, I love a bread bowl. When I was a kid, the novelty of a bread bowl, it's like, this is the greatest thing in the world.
I actually don't think I've ever eaten anything out of a bowl of bread.
Bowl you could eat? You should try it, buddy. It's incredible.
No, I mean, it sounds appealing.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie.
I can't believe that statement.
No, it's true. Shocking, but true.
All right, so I'm on the board here with the back-to-back snake picks, right?
Yeah.
You are.
I'm going to go with a butternut squash.
Ooh.
Sure.
Strong.
And I'm going to go with a chicken noodle.
Yeah. Classic.
Both strong. Yeah. Chicken noodle had to go at some point here. I will go, I'll go cream of mushroom, which is just something classic about it.
That's nasty,
I love it,
bro.
I don't care. I've got chili and clam chowder.
That's a Najee Harris of soups.
I know. Are you gonna throw that on a casserole or something?
Yes.
Cream of
exactly.
mushroom. But then it's not soup. Then it's a topping.
No, then it's soup on a casserole.
You drafted a condiment. You might as well drafted ketchup. Might as well pay tribute to Cheech. My last pick, I'm going to go hot and sour.
Ooh.
Hot and sour soup. So I got hot and sour, ramen, and pho. I am laughing, brothers. You've got chicken noodle.
Butternut squash and tomato soup.
And you got...
cream of mushroom.
Yeah.
Chili.
And a condiment.
I wouldn't lead with cream of mushroom. I would save that for last.
You guys missed a huge one.
Which?
The Thai coconut curry soups.
Ooh, I do like some like, what's it, Tom Young guy?
Yeah, or like just a, like... chicken spicy Thai soup.
Yeah. The lemongrass soup. Mm. That's good. You know what? Jamie should have taken it instead of cream of mushroom.
No,
that's,
French onion?
French onion.
I'm not
damn.
The biggest French onion.
I'm a big
guy.
French onion.
I don't
onion
mind
guy.
It, but it, no, not on my draft.
Instead,
what about broccoli cheddar?
I'm not a big broccoli cheddar soup person myself, but I know people who like it. All I'm saying is cream of mushroom is the Mac Hollins of soup.
No. This is one of those instances.
You mean a sneaky good play this week?
No. This is one of those where you leave the draft and you instantly drop cream of mushroom so you can pick up a different soup.
100%. So you can pick up Tom Young.
No, I just have chili. My plate's full with chili and clam chowder, man. I couldn't even conceive of needing a third soup.
Yeah, until one of them goes down week 5 and you're scrambling.
Yeah, you need a hank up soup.
All right. On that note, we will wrap it up. Thank you to Dim. Thanks to everyone for listening. Have a great weekend. We're back on Monday here on Sportsnet 650.